Well, now so. We're entering the seventh week. And as we do so, we return to the meditative cultivation of mudita. Literally, it simply means joy or delight. But it has a connotation of empathetic joy. And the way I'd like to invite you to venture into this practice, each of us having an utterly unique practice, meditation, that will follow, will be to start from the present moment and to evaluate for yourself, individually, how content you are, how satisfied you are with where you are, and the trajectory, the path that you're following. Are you content to be you in motion? So if you ask me, am I content? Okay, Alan, this is as good as you're ever going to get. Today, this is the best you'll ever be. I'd say, whoa, that sucks. Man, I was hoping for more than that. So no, I'm not satisfied. To be this endpoint, this is as good as it gets. And all those other people got to become Buddhas and so forth, and I'm stuck here? Man, that sucks totally. I'm at, you know, I want a rebate. I'm not satisfied at all. But if I ask myself this very personally, am I content to be where I am in motion, with an awareness of where I've come from, the awareness of where I'd love to go to, where I will gladly devote my time, my effort, my energy, my enthusiasm for the path to the future of how I'd love to transform myself as an individual, what I'd love to be able to offer to others, what I'd love to be able to receive from others. Am I content to be in this trajectory? I think you can probably guess my answer. Yeah. Content to be in motion. Content to be in motion. Satisfied. And yet very dynamically, creatively, buoyantly dissatisfied. And there's the balance. There's the balance. And that is, if we tip over, it's like that, I think there's at least one surfer here. It's almost impossible, isn't it, Beth, if I can call on you? It's almost impossible, isn't it, for a surfer just to ride the crest of the wave and ride the whole wave right on the crest, not get down into it, not fall over the back. Isn't that almost impossible, just to ride right on the top all the way across? For a long time, yeah, it would take just incredible balance, I would think. To not slip down and not slip back, but just as the wave is breaking, just being right there on the surf. That's where we need. That's the surfer we need to be. And that is not falling over the precipice into just flat out dissatisfaction, grumpiness, low self-esteem. Man, I was expecting more. It's a bummer to be me. You know, down to that, low self-esteem, disappointment, self-directed disappointment, not having lived up to our expectations, as if the story's already over. As if the story's already over. And we didn't really like the way it turned out. You know, like we came to the final page of the book, and that was a letdown. No more, huh? Okay. Bummer. You know, that's going to be self-defeating. On the other hand, in a much more seductive way, we may be so satisfied that the edge is gone. The edge is gone. And we slip right back into complacency. Happy just to repeat yesterday. This is pretty good. I'm really pretty okay. Compared to most people, I'm pretty okay. Yeah, in fact, I'm good enough. In fact, I'm better than most, and that's definitely good enough. And just being hanging in there. Kind of, once again, self-defeating, because you've just closed the door to any revolutionary future. So that cutting edge there, Tsongkhapa speaks of this, when this man of just almost unimaginable erudition and the vastness of his knowledge. I do find it personally intimidating that somebody could know so much and bring it all together, thoroughly integrated. And he was really a genius of the highest order, let alone, you know, a spiritual master, a meditator, a bodhisattva, and all of that. But in terms of the thirst for knowledge, and he had it par excellence, you know, par excellence, from the time he was a child. Like, he just had this voracious appetite, and it carried right through his adolescence into adulthood, just voracious, just, you know, never satisfied. And he said, that's what you should have. That is, never be satisfied in terms of how much understanding and knowledge and insight and wisdom you've acquired. Always be ready for more. Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche was that way. Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche lived to, I think over 80. But right towards the end of his life, I saw a wonderful movie that was made by him, Brilliant Moon. It's a lovely movie. I strongly recommend. And he was very senior lama. I think it was only a few years before he passed away. And there was a narration in this film about some very simple monk. He looked like just totally ordinary monk. Had asked, could he please have an audience with the great, the truly great, Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche. And so, okay, we have a bit of time. You can have some time with him. And so this simple, ordinary monk went in with his one-on-one interview, audience with Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche. And the attendants were waiting outside, and the time went on and on and on and on and on. And it's kind of like, whoa, what's up with that? And finally, it was over. And it turned out that this very simple monk had some transmission, had received some teaching that Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche hadn't received. And Dingo Rinpoche asked him to transmit it to him, you know. That kind of insatiability. So to maintain that for wisdom, and Tsongkhapa emphasizing the wisdom aspect, but also one can be insatiable in wanting to deepen, never being satisfied with the scope, the depth, the sheer volume of one's compassion, one's loving kindness for others, not being satisfied. If you still find a little bit of lumpiness as you attend to other sentient beings, a little bit more here, a little bit less there, not satisfied, then my loving kindness is not immeasurable. Not here, I'm dissatisfied. One person comes in at 10 o'clock one day, another person comes at 10 o'clock, having a bit of preference. To this person over that person. I'm not satisfied. That's not good enough. Old, young, handsome, ugly. If there's any preference, I'm not satisfied. Right? Totally unsatisfactory. That's embarrassment if any Dharma teacher feels that. I like the younger ones. I like the prettier ones. I like the handsome ones. I like the rich ones. Bring me the rich students. I like them better. What a disgrace. If there's even a little bit of movement in that direction, it's a disgrace. Shame, big shame on Buddha Dharma. You know, really true. So to consider where you are now, to take stock, to do the zoom lens and zoom out to wide angle and look where you are in your life now. And are you content? Dynamically, discontentedly, richly content. Right there in the balance. I think that's where to be. And as you take stock of that, whether you're content to be in this flow, in this direction, this momentum, this vision that you have for your own flourishing, and not simply some carrot that you're holding off in the future, one day maybe I'll achieve shamatha, one day maybe I'll achieve something, but are you content to be in that flow? Then as you do so, having kind of set the stage, where are you now and are you content? Are you satisfied dynamically satisfied to be following the path, the vision that you have for your own flourishing? Then to go back from that basis, that will be our entry into the meditation. And then go back and reflect, how did you get here? If you're really content, I'm looking for a better word. Because as you can tell, I do not mean at all complacent. Satisfied, content, maybe there's some other word. That's about the best, good as I can come. But taking delight in, it's more than, okay, if you go to a restaurant and you order a $10 meal and they give you a $10 meal, okay, I'm content. What did I expect? It was a $10 meal, I got a $10 meal. Okay, whatever, you know. So that's content, but it's no big deal. Now, this is not only content, or I'm satisfied, I paid $10, that's a $10 meal. Yeah, what do you expect? Not bad, not great. Okay, right? But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something that has more zest to it. Some sense of delight, some sense of deep satisfaction. Mudita, that's what I'm actually getting at. Mudita, a real sense of delight, of rejoicing. How good it is to be where I am now, in this current, in this flow, with this direction, how marvelous it is, way beyond content, way beyond satisfied, reveling in this wave that you've caught now. If you can come to that point, to the extent that you can come to that point, that vision, that appreciation, that evaluation of where you are now in motion, then go back. So that would be the first phase. Just check it out. I'm not asking you this, you should be feeling this or that, but check it out and see to the extent to which you can really experience mudita for where you are now, today and yesterday, this flow and tomorrow, and then go back. Then go back. Go back to infancy. Go back to childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, and however far. Some of us can't go much beyond a young adulthood. Not there yet. But for those of us who are way beyond, like me, way beyond young adulthood, then you can be checking out the decades after young adulthood. And look back now in terms of cause and effect. If you're really dynamically content, if you can really experience mudita with respect to where you are now in motion, go back. Go down memory lane and just check out what were the circumstances, who were the people, what were the events you encountered, what contributed year by year, decade by decade, what contributed to your being where you are now. As we've done this in the past, in the earlier meditations, it's been a little bit mudita light in the sense that we have sought to overcome a natural psychological imbalance that I suspect is probably pretty generic. I don't think it's just modern and Western. But it would be interesting to see, because I don't really know. But what I'm referring to is, for example, as a teacher, if you're teaching, elementary school, anything, doesn't have to be Dharma at all. But if you're a teacher and you have 20 students in the class, and 19 of them just think you're a wonderful teacher, and they love you, and they give you apples and dark chocolate, and they just think you're a wonderful teacher, and one of them just thinks you suck. You know, you're just really a big disappointment and have not proven effective. And they really want out to another class. And they write to the principal, maybe your school teacher, and say, this one's really a knucklehead. This one's really a poor teacher. And maybe let you know as well, you know, I've had many teachers, but you're really towards the bottom of the list, you know. And then 19 of them are saying, you're right towards the top of the list. You're really fantastic. You go home, which one do you remember? Do you go home feeling, what percentage would that be? 95% happy? Do you go home 95% happy thinking of 19 of them just taking delight on all of their appreciation and their gratitude and so forth, and then that was that one and kind of balanced, but feel 95% happy? Or do you feel absolutely dominated by the one that just thinks you suck? And the other ones that think you're just great, well, whatever. They probably didn't mean it anyway. And you just go right back to the one who is really grumpy and crabby and thinks you really stink. You know? So I think this may just be a modern... I mean, I'm a modern Westerner, so I know what this is like, and I know exactly the one I'll attend to. You know, by sheer habit. I'm going to attend to the negative one, of course. And the other one's, yeah, whatever. But that one really didn't like me at all. And so, likewise, as for a classroom, likewise, if something really rotten happened last year, and a whole bunch of good things happened last year, which one really catches the attention more? 20 really good things and one really rotten thing. And I think overall, we tend to hit the rotten one. And of course, we see this absolutely everywhere in the media. Check out the front page of any newspaper at any time and see if you can find any good news. Lots of luck with that one. That's back way on page 13, you know. Mother saves child or something, you know, something nice. But that's kind of like human interest story. But all the news is bad news, right? So there's a whole orientation there. So mudita, and I mentioned this before, and so I'm going to be very brief now, but mudita is try to be a little bit more realistic. And that is, you know, over the course of a life, it's so easy to reflect upon, to dwell upon, to attend to and thereby make real for us in the present moment, the negative, from early childhood on. My earliest memory, I mean, this is no big deal, but my earliest memory that I can consciously bring to mind now is trying to climb up, when I was living in Scotland as a wee tyke, and I was trying to climb up a slide when my sister was coming down the slide. She was 4 years older than I, so a lot more mass. And she told me, get out of the way, get out of the way, because she wanted to come down, and I was a stupid little three-year-old, and I just, with a big grin, was crawling up the slide. And she said, get out of the way. And I kept on crawling up the slide. She came down, and I got it right in the face, you know. So that's my first memory of sister's teeth, feet in my face, you know, knocked me off the slide. And my second memory was also really quite unpleasant, but I will not belabor you with a point. Nothing traumatic, but it was just like, well, I will tell you. I was 5 years old living in Switzerland, and I think it was with my sister again. She's a lovely sister, by the way. Really, you could not ask for a nicer sister than mine, and I tell you no lie. She's a wonderful sister. But when I was like 5 years old, and she was therefore nine, we're living in Switzerland, we were sledding down a hill. It was winter, snow, and so forth. And there was this ledge where the sled went airborne. And I'm 5 years old, and I haven't really learned about Newton yet. And gravity. It scared the crap out of me. Like, we just took off. And I was thinking, bye, Mom, bye, Dad. We're going someplace else. You know? And it was really quite terrifying to be airborne at five with a sister who seemed to know everything. And we did hit the ground after all, and, you know, here I am. But that wasn't so certain when I'm 5 years old, airborne on a sled. And so that's my second memory. Third one was much happier, but that one we'll skip because who cares about good memories? So hedonically, we're balancing out. With mudita, we're balancing out. We're attending to deliberately focusing on those who've shown us kindness, who've supported us, friendship, love, guidance, knowledge, and so forth and so on. We've done that. But I'd like to go deeper. I'd like to go deeper this afternoon. And that's why I prefaced the comments this afternoon with, are you dynamically content to be in the flow where you are now? And as we consider, insofar as you can say yes, some it may be a flamboyant yes, perhaps others, perhaps a more muted yes, but I'm hoping that to some extent you'll be able to say yes. As we consider what was the whole range of causes and conditions that were really influential in directing you this way and that way, big life decisions. And one of them was rather big decision, coming here for 8 weeks. That's not trivial, right? But those circumstances in life that led you here and then led you there and the people you encountered and how they treated you. And what I'm getting at is this, that many of the, in terms of influencing us, guiding us, inspiring us, motivating us to come to Dharma, to seek genuine happiness and not simply try to be lucky in a whole string of hedonic pleasures, there are many, many influences. And they're not all pleasant. And it's not all because people have been very deliberately keep treating us with kindness. Some of the most difficult situations, some of the most difficult people, some of the greatest struggles, challenges, and suffering we've experienced. The most difficult people we've encountered from childhood on. Their influence on us can also play a very major role in our being inspired to find Dharma and not simply being content with, boy, I'm lucky, I hope I'm lucky more, let's be lucky in samsara and just seek hedonic pleasure. Because if everything's going so smoothly, why would you ever look for Dharma? I wouldn't. I was very unhappy for no good reason in the world when I was 20. I had not a reason in the world to be unhappy. If you look at everything around me, loving parents, wonderful girlfriend, brand new car, doing well in university. I mean, what more do you want? You're living in California. I mean, I could have been living in Idaho. No, Idaho is nice. But some state that's not California. You know, I could have been living someplace else. But California, it's like a nice state. And there I was with everything going for me, even when I envisioned my future, I mean, hedonically, like, what's your problem? And my dad couldn't figure it out. I was so dissatisfied. He couldn't, what more do you want, son? And we've done everything we possibly can for you. And you're going around, like this. You know. And it wasn't Dharma. That was the little problem. For me, it wasn't Dharma. there was nothing there. It was just like feeding me paper, you know, or sand. There was just no hope. No hope. At the age of 20, I was looking, I can see the whole life that you're setting out before me, and I don't want it. It's going to be more of the same, and I don't want it. And the people around me could not figure it out, especially my poor father, because he really loved me. He still loves me. He's still alive. But he couldn't figure it out. What's wrong? What do we need? You need a better car? You need two girlfriends? What do you need? You know? And of course, the thing was, I don't want more of the same. And had it not been for that dissatisfaction, there's no way that I would have made the sacrifices that I did to go to India to meet His Holiness Dalai Lama and so forth and so on. So I could go on and on here. But I will tell you one of the most poignant stories that I know. Some of you have heard it undoubtedly, but it's worth telling again. It's the very thumbnail sketch of the life of one of my teachers, very revered teachers, Gungobashi, the one who taught me the 7-point mind training. And as some of you may recall, some of you know my life a little bit, I was already in India, I was fluent in Tibetan. It was like 1973. I learned quickly, I had fantastic teachers, perfect opportunity to learn, and I went total immersion, so I was fluent in a couple of years. And it was just about that time when I had become fluent and I could understand all the lamas and I could read pretty much any text with help. And I was one of the very, very few Westerners in Dharamsala at that time who could speak and read. And all this array of lamas, I mean, both tutors of His Holiness Dalai Lama were alive, at Serkon Rinpoche, and the list goes, Geshe Rabten and Geshe Ngan Taigi and Lhatje Rinpoche, and the list went on and on. These, I mean, really fantastic teachers. And here was finally this white guy, this Westerner who could actually talk their language, because there are only one or two interpreters in the whole town, and they're in incredibly high demand. So here's one guy who doesn't need an interpreter. And these lamas are so compassionate. And basically, I knew it. At that point, I was 23, I felt I could ask any of these lamas for any teaching, and they'll give it to me. You know, because no language barrier. And they knew I was sincere. And so there was one teaching that I hadn't received, I mean, hadn't received many teachings, but one that I really wanted to receive that I hadn't, was teachings on Lojong, or the mind training. And specifically, I wanted to get the transmission on the 7-point mind training, right? And everybody has it. I mean, it's one of the most common teachings. And all traditions, Gagyu, Nyingma, Gelu, Sakya, they all adore this practice. It's like Bodhisattvatara, all teaching, you know, everybody's received it, everybody loves it, totally non-sectarian. 7-point mind training is the same. So I could have pretty much asked any lama, and they would all say it, and they know this is really authentic practice that can be really helpful. I think if I'd asked almost anyone, they probably would have given it, except for maybe lamas that are so much in demand, like the two tutors, His Holiness. I couldn't ask His Holiness, would you give me personal teachings? That's not happening. But apart from those who are in such, you know, such lofty positions of position, I could have had my choice. But by that time, I'd come to know of Gungobashi, who was not, he was not a monk, never been a monk. He was not a lama, didn't regard himself as a lama. But he was the principal instructor in the Tibetan Medical Center. He was the greatest teacher at that time. That was for decades, in the 70s, 80s. He was the greatest living teacher, probably anywhere, of Tibetan medicine, consummate. But not only Tibetan medicine, but he had vast erudition. And he knew Dharma very, very well. But it wasn't just that. I knew a lot of very erudite lamas, but this one, he really impressed me. I'd met him a number of times, and I lived in the Tibetan Medical Center for a couple of months just before I became a monk. And there was something about him, and I think compassionate, warm-hearted serenity would be the way I would sum up how he presented at all times. There was just always that, just like an ocean of serenity, but there was a sweetness about it, a kindness about it that was just palpable. And his whole life was just an ongoing flow of altruism, an expression of altruism. So, extraordinary teacher. But I knew something about his life as well, and that really inspired me to seek him out. So some of you know this story, so I have to hear it again. But he was an aristocrat. He was nobility. And when he was living in Tibet, his family own a number of estates, I think 2 or 3. So they were nothing even remotely like the fabulously rich we have nowadays, the Bill Gates and so forth and so on. But within that context, within traditional Tibet, he was a wealthy family. He had a couple of estates and a life of leisure. His wife, he was just a natural gentleman scholar. He had an easy life. And what he loved to do is he loved to study. He studied Buddhist epistemology and Buddhism and medicine and poetry and all kinds of stuff. And he had this incredibly, mind that could absorb it all. Just extraordinary memory, just massive amount of knowledge. And so that's what he loved to do. And so his wife, she took care of their estates. She was the practical one. She did all the practical stuff, ran the estates, and she just let him study all the time. He loved to study, right? And then came the Chinese communist invasion. And he being an aristocrat, to be an aristocrat was a criminal offense. I mean, that's what do you call it? That you get killed for that. You just you're an aristocrat, line up, and boom. That's what do they call it? It's a criminal offense, but it's a capital offense. If you are an aristocrat, you will die. We might torture you first, but you're going to die one way or another. And so that was it. That was his one crime. He was an aristocrat. And so, of course, when things got really unbearable around about the March 10th, 1959 uprising, then, of course, he knew he had to flee. So he and his wife, and he had a number of children. I don't know exactly how many, but he and his wife and one son managed to escape with almost nothing. I mean, when you're a landholder, you can't bring buckets of dirt with you. You know, your possessions are very local. They're not movable. And so he left with almost nothing, and he left, I think, at least 2 or 3 of his children behind. And among them, a couple, I think, were simply lined up against the wall and shot. But he never saw any of them again, except for the one son with whom he escaped with his wife. And his one son, and I don't know all the details of it, but he was so traumatized that he became psychotic. He was psychotic. And I knew him. We were friends. And so, having a major psychosis, he was at one point, I think just before I got to know him, he was put in a mental hospital in India and got electric shock treatment. And everything about it sounded absolutely horrific. Absolutely horrific. But he got out of there, and he was very fragile, very sweet man, gentle soul, the son, but very fragile, very fragile. And I knew him for a couple of years, and then he fell into psychosis again, and then he committed suicide. And so Kumabashi and his wife, hedonically speaking, they lost everything. They lost all of their possessions, all of the land. He knew at least 1 or 2 of his children had been simply murdered. The other ones he never saw again. The one son escaped, went insane, and then killed himself. And so when I knew him, he lived in a one-room shack that Alan and Mark could build in a day for about $100. Just put up 4 walls, put a tin roof on top of it, put in a light bulb, and say it's a good day's job. About one day, I think, yeah? One good hard day of work. That's where he lived. One-room shack with one light bulb. No toilet, no plumbing. He had to go to the nearest faucet for that. And and his salary as the chief instructor for the whole Tibetan Medical Center, with many, many students teaching them many, many fields, was, as I recall, $30 a month. So that's what he and his wife lived on. And he is one of the most contented people I've ever met in my life. And so I thought, if there's anybody I know of here in Dharamsala, who has been turned out to be a master of transforming adversity into the spiritual path, he would be a very high candidate. And so I asked him whether he'd give me the teachings, and he agreed, and so he did. And as he was giving me these teachings on the 7-point mind training, he made this comment that, of course, I haven't forgotten, and it's almost 40 years ago. He said, "I personally feel a deep sense of gratitude towards the Chinese communists and their invasion of the country and their impact on my life, the impact on my life. It's very, very personal, on my life. And of course, how is that possible?" And he said, "When I was in Tibet, when I lived in Tibet, my life was very easy, and I took everything for granted. The Dharma was easy. Life was easy. I enjoyed studying Dharma, but it was just so easy. Everything was easy. And then because of the kindness of the Chinese communists and losing everything, only because of that do I really see the value of Dharma. And it's really caused me to dedicate my life to Dharma, to see how immensely important it is. And so my utter dedication to Dharma, my living in Dharma, my practice of Dharma, would not have occurred had I not lost everything because of this invasion and occupation of the country and my personal loss. And so therefore, because they were catalysts, the People's Liberation Army and so forth, because they were catalysts to arouse in me the sense of renunciation and this faith in Dharma, this appreciation of Dharma, this love of sharing Dharma with others, because they were catalysts for that, then I feel gratitude for them. Because had it not been for that, I could have just gotten old and died in Tibet in a very comfortable, cushy way, with not much transformation at all. So as we look back, I think few of us, maybe there are people here who can match that story in terms of adversities you've encountered, or people that you've encountered who've treated you badly. Maybe some of you can match that story, but I think it would be hard. I'm not even close. That is, and when I look at people, you know, difficulties I've had with people, mine has just been a deva realm all the way through. But to be able to view adversity from that perspective, other people's mental afflictions, other people's behavior towards us. It could be a father, it could be a mother, it could be a brother or sister, it could be somebody we know just from a surrounding society, where the wound may still be open, we may still be hurting from it, there may be still resentment, there may be fear, it could be anxiety, there could be all kinds of things. But a sadness that I was treated that way, and that was so unjust, and that was undeserved. And why did you need to do that to me? I didn't deserve that. This feeling of being victim, victim, victim. And from one perspective, it's valid. It's valid. Was Kung Rinpoche a victim of the Chinese communists? Yeah, absolutely. What did he do to them? He wasn't even exploiting his own people. He was a very just man, a very kind man. I'm sure he treated all of his employees well. He was a lovely, warm man. I mean, he didn't start doing that when he came to India. So was he a victim? Hedonically speaking, yes. Hedonically speaking, from the mundane perspective, could he go through the rest of his life feeling, man, did I get the short end of the stick? Boy, did I get treated badly. It was absolutely horrible what they did to me. I've lost everything, and I didn't do anything harm to them at all, and they killed my children. My children didn't do anything. He could wallow so realistically in self-pity for the rest of his life and arouse the compassion of other people for him that, wow, that's a very, very sad story. You know, you really have my deep compassion. You know. And he shifted 180 degrees around. So he's feeling compassion for all those around him, including the Chinese communists. Because he knows full well that although he benefited from their taking everything away from him, he knows there's no benefit for them. They only acted out of greed, out of ignorance, out of hatred, racism, and so forth. So I think what I'm getting at here, maybe I'll sum up, is that there are these multiple valid perspectives. And neither one negates the other. Hedonically speaking, in terms of a mundane perspective, was he a victim? Could he realistically live the rest of his life in self-pity and sadness and quite realistically resentment, you know? And the answer is yes. Yes, that's a realistic view. You really, that was terribly, terribly unjust. And what a tragedy, you series of tragedies, right through the death of your only son who you thought you'd rescued. And you can live with that. And that can be your story. And you can reify it and say that's what absolutely happened. And take no delight in your life at all. Because such realistic grounds for just feeling self-pity and putting on the cloak of I'm the victim. And I'm the victim for the rest of my life. Because look what I had to bear. You know? Or you can change clothes and you can look at exactly the same reality. Exactly everything with 20/20 vision. Everything that came through. And you can see it all through the eyes of compassion and through the eyes of mudita, taking delight in all those who helped you in one way or another come to where you are now in a spirit of gratitude. And where those who have helped you, and as Shantideva says, we can have this sense of gratitude, and we shouldn't demand that they always had the benevolent motivation. If the effect was good, that's enough. That's enough. If the effect was good, that's enough for gratitude. You shouldn't expect that everybody around you, every person you ever meet, is always going to be having a benevolent motivation towards you. That's unrealistic. But if the effect was benevolent, if the effect was good, enriches your life, brings you to Dharma, enriches your Dharma practice, that's sufficient grounds for gratitude. So Shantideva says, if we are now viewing reality and viewing our lives, viewing the trajectory of our lives, through the vision, through the lens of the pursuit of genuine happiness, if that is now triumphing over, overwhelming the pursuit of might I be lucky, might I be lucky, might I be lucky, avoiding hedonic distress, finding hedonic pleasure, may I be happy, may I be lucky and ever so lucky. There's that view, and then there's the pursuit of genuine happiness, the dedication of Dharma. And if the dedication to Dharma, the prioritization of Dharma, vastly overwhelms our dedication to wanting to be happy every day because things are going so well for us, then the whole life, the whole of reality, looks different. It is different. It's rising up to meet us in a different way. So Shantideva gives this example. In order to follow this path to its culmination, the path to full awakening, to become a Buddha, there is no way to get there. There is no possible way to realize perfect awakening without bringing to perfection each of the six perfections, the first of which is generosity. You can't skip generosity and say, well, never mind that. I mean, I'm okay. Let's just go straight to ethics. Each one of these, the generosity, the ethics, the patience, enthusiasm, meditation, and wisdom, they all have to be brought to perfection, right? And the first one is generosity. Well, he comments, if you see this, if you recognize this, that I want my heart to be utterly open in a spirit of altruism, a spirit of generosity, a spirit of service. I want this to just be my whole lifestyle, my baseline, fundamental prime directive, if you like. But a spirit living a life that is an ongoing expression of generosity. For that to be aroused, cultivated, incited, I need to encounter people who can derive benefit from me. If you are walking around with $5 in your pocket and you're surrounded by millionaires, what are you going to do with your $5? They don't need your $5. You can't practice generosity. They don't need your $5. They can give you $5,000 and not even notice. So in order to really practice generosity, to bring it to its fullness, to let it flower, you need to find people who need you, who can benefit from your wealth. And of course, not just financial wealth, your knowledge, your kindness, your affection, your companionship, your skills, and so forth and so on. And any teacher knows that. Any teacher knows. Any good teacher, any teacher who loves to teach knows that you can derive so much benefit from teaching others and seeing them derive benefit from them. That's your primary payment, right? It's nice to make a living too. But if you see you can really benefit people, that's what really brings happiness to the heart. Paycheck, good, that's for paying rent and whatever. And so you need people. So Shantideva gives this point, if you really arouse this yearning, may I cultivate and perfect the spirit of generosity. And then right after you've aroused that thought, a beggar comes knocking on your door. Or maybe nowadays it wouldn't be a beggar so frequently, be, can you give to the American Red Cross? Can you give to this? Can you give to this? You know, we need funding for this, the latest tornado victims in the Midwest, the latest, you know, this, there's tragedies all over the world. Could you possibly make a donation? And you've just been hoping that somebody would look to you, needing something from you, and say, oh, you came right in time, thank you. Absolutely, yes, thank you. You know, because you can't practice generosity if nobody wants to receive your generosity. So that's a pretty simple example, right? And then he gives the much harder example. And that is, in order to achieve awakening, the complete openness of the heart, we can say also the full flowering, the four immeasurables, if we want to bring this a little bit closer. There's no way to get there. There's no way to get there unless we really cultivate this, the inner strength of forbearance, the fortitude of patience, of inner strength, fortitude, forbearance, the strength, the might of equanimity in the face of adversity. Right? There's no way. So I think it was Geshe Ngawang Taiki told me, if we look at the life stories, of all the enlightened beings that we have, going back, you know, through the history of Tibet, back to India, back to Buddha Shakyamuni, is that you look at any of those who in that very lifetime, like Milarepa and so many, many, many others, if you look at any of those who in this lifetime achieved tremendous spiritual realization or awakening, Buddhahood, you said you will not find one who had an easy life. You'll not find one that just had a lovely childhood and then a really sweet adolescence and then had a really nice adulthood and then achieved enlightenment and really enjoyed that too. You know, you won't find one. All of them, every single one, you'll find they've been major challenges. Milarepa is just one of the most famous examples. But had it not been for Milarepa's uncle, it sounded like a really nasty character, exploited his sister-in-law, right? Because Milarepa's dad died. And his dad's brother then, patriarchal society, he basically then got to be in charge of, to oversee the state of Milarepa's mom and his sister. And Milarepa, of course. But he was a nasty guy, greedy guy. So he basically, and it was his sister-in-law, not blood, so he probably, oh, whatever. And he just exploited and ripped them all off. His sister-in-law and his two children, ripped them all off, took their property, left them destitute. And so Milarepa's mother saw, boy, this absolutely stinks. I mean, I should be having a comfortable life. My husband's gone, but he left us well off. And his brother stole everything from us, left us in borderline poverty. And that worm got in her heart. She couldn't stand it. This is not right. This is not right. There goes the old mudra again, the fist. This is not, he had no right. He had no right. He should have treated us like family, and he just treated us to exploit us and to drive us into poverty. And she's a woman. She's not empowered in that society. Very few. Recently, much more so. But back then, no, she's a woman. She's one more. But she had a son. She had a son. The daughter didn't matter much. But the son grew up and let him be the fist of retaliation. And she raised him with that. Your raison d'être, why I gave birth to you, why I'm raising you, is you strike vengeance. Because what happened to us is just unjust. And we cannot bear it. We do not have to tolerate it. And I want you to hammer back so they feel it. And I'm going to raise you so you can. And so he was being raised as an instrument of vengeance. And he loved his mother. What's the boy going to do? His mother took care of him. His uncle didn't. Dad died. And so when he got the chance, he went off. He found the tools. It was through sorcery. He killed 35 people. And he made a very specific point. I mean, there was some really intense, steely malice in what Milarepa did. Because he killed 35 people. But the two he kept alive was his uncle and his aunt. He kept them alive. He could have killed them with everybody else. But he kept them alive. He wiped them out financially, wiped out all their relatives, and left them alone living so they could eat the bitter bile of seeing everything that they cherished lost. That's pretty mean. But his mother was satisfied. Because that's what she wanted him to do. I want you to strike back so they'll never forget it. And they didn't. And they lived quite some time after that in total destitute poverty, having lost all their loved ones and all of their wealth. And then Milarepa saw what he'd done. And he saw it was horrific. And being a Buddhist, he saw the karmic consequences of this are not going to be nice. And because of that recognition, he sought out Marpa, the great teacher, the great meditation master, went through all the travails and purifications and austerities that Marpa demanded of him to purify this horrendously evil karma that he accumulated. When he'd done so, then he gave him just the teaching he needed, launched him, and Milarepa became the most beloved yogi in the whole history of Tibet. But would have Milarepa have ever gotten there if his uncle hadn't been such a stinker? If he just kind of had a nice, comfortable life at Mama's farm and married some nice girl, Milarepa, you know, and just lived out their life as happy little farmers because hadn't done much wrong, hadn't done much right. So raise some nice barley, eat your tsampa, ride a yak, and die. You know, he could have just been one more anonymous peasant, except for his uncle, who catalyzed a whole sequence of events that led to him being this fabulous enlightened being. So as we review, this is where I will stop, as we review, consider who are your uncles. Who are the people who influenced you in ways that hedonically, there are no rose-tinted glances about it? Unjust, unkind, harsh, whatever adjective you wish, non-virtuous. Here are all the people who have manifestly served you, like Marpa and so forth, and Doc Memba, his wonderful wife. But as you review your life, see how much you can rejoice in, and the bandwidth to which you can express and expand your sense of gratitude, not only to those who provided you with hedonic pleasure, who've explicitly shown kindness, but even to those who, in one way or another, have helped you find your path. And without being silly, if you think their motivations were really negative, afflictive, recognizing that, but looking back with gratitude, as Gungo Barshi did, and so many others, who looking back on their own past, looking back with a vision of genuine happiness, see all of this as leading to their own awakening. And looking back upon the whole past with gratitude. Because it took the whole past to get you where you are now. All of it to get you where you are right now. Not just the nice people. It took all of it to get you where you are now. So you light in it. And then, as we attend to those who have treated us badly, fundamentally, of course, it always comes down to the same thing. Out of their own delusion. It always comes back to that. Doesn't matter what they've done. Robbing a country, robbing you, treating you on verbal abuse, physical abuse, and the list goes on and on. It always comes back to ignorance and delusion, which nobody chooses. So as you attend to this, and attend perhaps even in a spirit of gratitude, in gratitude the thought might arise. Because of your influence on my life, that has been one of the many, many, many influences that have led me to seek Dharma, to develop a spirit of emergence, renunciation. Whoever develops renunciation without suffering? The answer is no one. No one ever develops renunciation. Whoever becomes disillusioned with hedonic pleasure without suffering? No one. Whoever seeks liberation without suffering? No one. And whoever experiences deep compassion for others without having experienced suffering oneself? No one. The deeper the suffering, the deeper the potential pool of compassion is to arise. Out of suffering comes renunciation. Out of suffering comes compassion. If there's anything more important than the whole of Dharma, than a sense of renunciation and compassion, I'm not quite sure what it would be. But it comes only because of difficulties and challenges and suffering. And so as we attend to those who have given us these challenges, whatever the motivations may have been, as we attend to them, we may attend to them with a sincere sense of gratitude. Gratitude arousing the aspiration, you've been a catalyst for me to find Dharma, to find a genuine path to authentic happiness, awakening, fulfillment. You have been perhaps even an instrumental catalyst. And whatever your motivations were, I don't know. Maybe they were completely afflictive. But your impact on me has been to bring me, help me, catalyze me, come to Dharma. May I repay the kindness by helping you find the path that is suitable to you, that you too can be free of suffering and its causes and find genuine happiness and its causes. Whether it's a Christian path or a Jewish, a Buddhist, that's not the issue. The path that is suitable for you. May I help you in whatever way I can to realize your own Buddha nature and to find happiness. So let's practice. Mudita. Questions about the practice. There are all kinds of theoretical issues we can go into, but our time now is quite explicitly short. So we'll start with Rachel.
Could you talk a little bit more about this way of bracketing the practices that you call balancing earth and wind and earth and sky? Mm-hmm. What the source of that is, and also the
what
source?
The source?
Are you the source, or is there another source?
For the combinations, yes, I'm the source. Yeah. Yeah, the practices themselves. So I'm kind of like a chef that all the ingredients were already given by the great lineage, and I just put a few of them together in chefy ways.
So what was your purpose in doing that, and what do you see the benefit as being?
Very good. Very, very practical. Each, as you well know, individually, each of these practices really is classic. And I'm simply the transmitter for them. And having been a Westerner for a long time and taught Westerners for most of my life, actually, I've been teaching Dharma for 35 years, finding that so very frequently, number one, in terms of my own experience, and then number two, in terms of almost everybody I engage with, that maintaining too high a level of tension, of tightness, constriction, and so forth, and all the psychological stuff that go with it, low self-esteem and all of that, is such a ubiquitous problem, so widespread. And so many problems arising from meditation come exactly from that source. 90-95% all come over-striving, blah, 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 like that. And of course then, some people recognize that, and then they recognize, oh, no striving, I get it, just be here now, be open to whatever comes up, there's nothing to achieve, don't talk about karma reincarnation, that's irrelevant, and nothing to achieve, just be open and embrace everything. And to my mind, that's just one more extreme, that's just the extreme of complacency. You know, within that sugarcoating, but still, it's just complacency. I'm fine, you're fine, let's all just be happy and be here now. The Buddha did went all that austerity for that. That was his message. You know, that's pretty pathetic to my mind. So we go back to these two classic practices, really utterly so quintessential to the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions when it comes to shamatha. And these are the two great peaks that rise up, settling the mind, awareness of awareness. And as you well know, I have just the utmost reverence and appreciation and love with these practices. And ever so often, especially when the people in modernity, and they could be from Mongolia, they can be from Tibet, from Singapore, it's modernity is modernity now, engaging in these practices, ever so often, there starts to arise kind of a tension, a tightness. It manifests in the face, in the body, the breathing, the mind. And then all the stuff comes up. And then, you know, and so it, for both of these practices, they really need to be balanced out. And it may very well be different if you've been a nomad for the first 30 years of your life, and then you go directly from there to a monastery and go off to a shamatha retreat. You might not have anything to unwind. So because of this, just the whole pace of modernity globally, it's no longer East and West, then for these sublime practices that are just so rich, so incredible, to take us there to the depths of substrate, the source of our relative minds, then to balance this out, to keep on coming back. And taking very seriously that winding road and the decreasing level of effort needed all the way along. So that's why I found that when people, for myself, of course, I'm initially drawing from my own experience and then finding how relevant this may be to others, that the more intensive we are, the more dedicated, the more ardent our aspiration and passion is to apply ourselves to these practices, the more we need to learn how to relax. And then it's not just, are you relaxed now? Okay, good. Now let's get on with it. But it's an ongoing flow of relaxation that continues until you're enlightened, and only then do you achieve the perfection of enlightenment. So balancing earth and wind, you know what? It's just my terminology. So that's fresh, but it's just shorthand. It's like I invented Q&A instead of having to say question and answer, Q&A, you know? Well, earth and wind is like Q&A. It's nothing. There's nothing new there at all. But it's balancing this facing into the wind of the thoughts like the kestrel kiting into the wind and facing the winds of the emotions, thoughts, memories, and all of that arising. And when you've been in that brisk flow of all kinds of stuff arising, then sometimes just coming back to the earth, supine position perhaps, but back to the body, back to the just breathing in and out, the tangibility of it, the groundedness of it. So those two, and the more relaxed you are in mindfulness of breathing in any of the three ways, then the more effectively goes settling the mind. The more settling the mind goes, the more vividly you're aware of whatever's arising in the mind. So when you go back to mindfulness of breathing, your introspective abilities will be all the more sharply honed, and you'll recognize more quickly, more vividly, the occurrence of coarse, medium, subtle excitation. So you're going to get a beautiful synergy going there, and they really enhance each other, right? And then likewise, then with fewer words, likewise for awareness of awareness. The first time I think I ran the cartoon earlier, so I won't do it again. The first time I really applied myself to that, I just stopped breathing. Not because I'd achieved the fourth jhana, and not because I was dead, you know, but I just didn't want to miss anything, you know, like that. And so I'd never heard about settling the respiration in this natural rhythm, and never heard really strong emphasis on relaxation. So of course I wound myself tight as a wire. So all the more so for that very subtle, that ever so subtle practice of awareness, coming back, back home, and just breathing in and out. So the more deeply you relax in that, the sharper the awareness of awareness can go. Balance earth and sky, so awareness of awareness, of course, symbolized by sky, the sheer space of awareness, and the earth always coming back to the body, the tangibility of tactile sensations. Is that enough?
I'm so glad I asked. That's really helpful. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad.
So my main practice is mindfulness of breathing.
I just missed the first part of the sentence.
What I'm mainly doing is mindfulness
practice
of breathing.
Practice is mindful breathing, yes.
And so what I've heard you describe is mostly the benefits of bracketing the practices when you're doing the other two practices.
Mm-hmm.
What I've started to find with doing that bracketing is that the meditations just feel really choppy.
Choppy.
It's like, oh, what am I meditating on now? You know, it's like switch mm-hmm. the focus.
Right.
So I feel like there's a little bit of cost.
A little bit of conflict.
Of cost. Cost.
Cost?
Can somebody translate that into an American
accent? C-O-S-T?
C-O-S-T.
Yeah, so there's cost. In going back and forth. Yeah. You can think of it, it occurred to me only during this retreat, something just a little tiny insight. And that is that this whole process of going from mindfulness of breathing to settling the mind to awareness of awareness is really like getting a closer and closer shave, you know. And so when we're attending mindfulness of breathing, that we've shaved off the 4 out of 5 of the sense fields. We just shaved it off. No interest, no thanks. If you disappear entirely, I'll be quite content. So the eyes are open, don't see anything, don't hear anything, no smell, no taste, and it's just tactile, and you're in that flow. So we've shaved off 4 out of 5. And we've left only 2, and that is the tactile and the mental. And so while you're doing that, you've eliminated 4 out of 5. That's a lot. And now you're focusing on the tactile sensations. But, of course, to do the practice fully, you need not only mindfulness of breathing, but you also need to be practicing introspection to monitor what's happening in the mind. And, of course, when you're doing either of these, the mindfulness or the introspection, how can you not be aware that you're aware? I mean, that would be a real serious problem if you weren't even aware. So we're seeing in this practice, you are practicing mindfulness of breathing. You're also monitoring the mind, and you're also aware of awareness. You have to be, right? Otherwise, you've gone into oblivion. And then we go to settling the mind, and now we just chuck out another one. Now we chuck out the tactile, that is no interest. So it still arises, but no interest. Now we're just focusing on the space of the mind and its contents. But of course, we're also aware that we're doing it. So now, we've just now eliminated 5 out of 5. Of the physical senses. Then you go from there to awareness of awareness, you knocked out another one, you know, the space of the mind and all its contents. You basically went 6 for 6, you know, and it's just awareness of awareness. So when you see that there's actually a common flow through all of them, and in a way, mindfulness of breathing also, at least partially, covers settling the mind, not in the same way, but you must be aware of those thoughts and so forth, and there's also awareness of awareness, otherwise there's something really cognitively a problem, you know. But I would simply say experiment with this and find that middle way. And that is, it's possible to be so choppy that if 5 minutes into the session you're finding mindfulness breathing isn't going so well, then you say, okay, this isn't going well. Too many thoughts. So let's go to settling the mind. And you do that. This isn't going so well. Let's go back to mindfulness breathing. I don't like this either. That's probably it. Awareness of awareness. And basically, like going into a restaurant where you don't like anything they serve. And what you don't like is your own mind. Can I simply have a mind transplant? You know, I'd like Matthew's mind, or, you know, how about let's go for broke? Why not deal with Kensington, but you're His Holiness, and they just have another mind because this one really it's a poor diner, you know, cheap food, it's fast food, you know, it's a problem. And so there's one extreme, and the other extreme is being so locked in that we just keep on slogging away even when it's very unsatisfying. We don't really want to do it, and so forth. But if we see this smoothness, then in mindfulness of breathing, when you're kind of getting into that flow, and I would say there's nothing that succeeds like success, you know, the old aphorism. And so in mindfulness of breathing, if you can be there in the supine position, for example, and say, you know, I can really do this. And really doing this means I am getting more and more relaxed, and I'm not getting dopey. I'm not losing my clarity. I'm doing this correctly, and I'm in stage 1, and it's really not that bad. I don't want to stay here. But, you know, as a first place, this is stage 1. Not bad. Just okay. And I succeeded. I am practicing correctly the infirmary. And I am feeling quite relaxed. At the end of the session, feeling, yeah, my mind's still going blah, 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 but that was expected. Didn't expect anything less or more. And so from that, then saying, well, how about stability, maybe here, you know, the abdomen. And from that, saying, yeah, there are sequences of breaths, 3 or 4 or 5 breaths that I don't lose it. I don't get kicked off the bucking bronco of my breath, you know. And then succeeding there, perhaps coming up to the nostrils, perhaps not, if there's any problem here of the cartilage or allergies or, you know, congestion and so forth, skip that one. But overall in mindfulness of breathing, when you have a sense that you are more or less anchored, it's already 6, but you're in that kind of flow, you are continually engaged, and you are aware of this medium excitation that's kind of like waves washing up on the rocks of your awareness, you know, not knocking the rocks down, but whoosh, whoosh, whoosh of the waves washing up on your flow of mindfulness of breathing. But when you see that, and you see they're arising, but I'm not carried away by them. I'm aware of them, and yeah, I would prefer them to not be here, but I get it, you know, they're not just sucking me up. I'm for 10, 15, 20 seconds at a time, I'm not carried away. Then you might think, maybe this is good enough. I could experiment with settling the mind. But when you find that you're all awash, that you're just totally caught up in coarse excitation, settling the mind may not be so good. Because what's happening here is not enough relaxation. Yeah. So more and more relaxation, more and more sense of ease. And then likewise with settling the mind, as you get more and more of the flow of that, you're more vividly aware of the intervals between thoughts, the space of the mind, and especially there, when you're just aware of the space of the mind, but you haven't gone into oblivion, like what, you know, just like no knowledge, no, just what, like, no knowledge at all. But you are knowing, yep, that's the space of the mind, there it is. It's three-dimensional. It is what it is. And you're aware of that. Then you're just right next door. You're right next door to being aware that not only aware of it, but you're also aware of your awareness. There's not much happening here. A vacuity and your awareness of the vacuity. And so why not just drop the vacuity and just take one step back, and then you aren't awareness of awareness. So all of these kind of, they're right next door to each other. And in that way, I think you can find your transition. But it's also just experimenting, that it's not so rigid that you're locked in and not so flaky that you're always just skipping around looking for a better meal. Okay?
Thank you. There's lots there to think about. That's really
Say nice. Again?
There's lots there to think about. Thank
Jolly
you.
Good.
Very helpful.
Good. Yeah. Just not while doing mindfulness of breathing. Because I know there's no question in my mind that I've served as probably, for many of you, the primary source of agitation for you for the whole retreat has been coming from my lips. So I'm not going to apologize, but I'm aware of that. And that's what Sundays are for. Not having me agitate your minds. So all good, all good. It's a little bit past 6 o'clock. So yeah, let's go have dinner.